This podcast brought to you by Petzl, the leaders in the light industry.
They are the leaders in the torch industry, Don.
Scott, when am I going to learn?
You know, it is the holiday season coming up, and what a better gift to give your running friend, partner, or associate than the gift of running. To elongate that winter season for those of us in the Northern Hemisphere, and those of us in the backward world that still believe in daylight savings time, It's shrunk our day. We don't have as much light in the day, and so that shrinks our training possibility, the number of hours we can train. With Petzl, that hurdle is eliminated.
Oh, that excuse is gone.
It is, because you can run with a Petzl head torch as if it were noon.
You said gift. You said gift a friend, gift a running partner, gift someone that you care about. But how about Mother Earth? Because you're not throwing away batteries and discarding them as non-recyclable. Thank you. You're not throwing that trash away, that poison. You're recharging.
You know, I thought that was a bunch of hooey when you first brought that up, but I have really seen a benefit in that.
What, never going out with it with a dull torch?
Yeah, I have in my truck a charger that I just plug it in when I'm done, and I come out with a full charge every time.
Why would you think that was full of hooey? To every time I strap on that Petzl, I say, Scott, I've got a full battery.
I know.
And there's nothing like a full battery.
I'm just telling you, I'm a believer. So go to Petzl.com, look at the Tika RXP or the Now.
The Now has some lumen.
Yeah. The Now and the Tika RXP, the reason why we like both of those is they do have the reactive technology, so they adapt to where you're looking automatically, and they both have the rechargeable batteries.
Go to Petzl.com and buy yourself one. You deserve it.
And today's podcast is brought to you in part by Injinji. Go to Injinji.com and check out their socks. They are socks for your toes.
Toe socks.
I want to tell you about a pair that I just bought.
All right. I'm always interested in hearing about something you bought.
Usually I like the lightweight socks. Here we're in the northern hemisphere. It's getting a little chillier outside. I bought a brand new pair of the Trail 2.0 midweight mini crew socks. Ran in them this morning.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Hmm.
It was like putting my feet back in my bed.
What? Climbing into a pair of Injinjis is like climbing back in bed, Scott?
It is. You know, it was hard getting out of bed, but by putting these socks on, I felt like at least my feet were back in bed.
A bed for each toe.
Go shop at Injinji.com, and at checkout, if you put in the code TRNATION, you will get 20% off your entire order.
That's 10% from Scott and 10% from me.
Go check them out. Get some Injinjis for a reduced rate and help support TRN.
Are we recording?
Dr. Romanoff, you're probably very experienced at professional interviews. This is not one of them.
Come on. Don't put yourself down.
we are very casual. That's a good word.
Ashley, were you expecting a professional podcast?
No, I wasn't. Apparently not. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
And it was a miserable, miserable day.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
And I'm Scott Warr. And today we have one of our favorite guests, Dr. Phil Maffetone. He is the author of two very big books, a yellow one and a red one. The red one is the big book of health and fitness. The yellow one is the big book of endurance training and racing. And if you don't have those somewhere on your bookshelf or your electronic whatever reader, you better get it, because you're not a runner unless you've read those two books.
You know, he may have done more to single-handedly slow down runners than any single person on the planet, and at the same time provide faster finishing times. Go figure out how to do that. Slow runners down, and then in a net gain, speed everybody up.
That's an oxymoron.
Well, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about slowing down and speeding up.
And today, we're talking about speeding up. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about Dr. Phil's new book, 159, which is the infamous marathon time to break, as like the 4 minute mile was years ago. No one's been able to break the 2 hour marathon, and Dr. Phil years ago wrote an article and has revised that article, and now he's finally come up with a book on how he thinks the 159 marathon time will be broken.
Welcome back, Dr. Maffetone.
Scott and Don, it's really great to be with you. And we always have a lot of fun, and I'm expecting that this hour.
Absolutely. You know,
I'm waiting.
At the Trail Runner Nation group, we have a group that formed called the Maffetonians.
Do we?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. I do remember that.
And I'll tell you, I appreciate, Phil, the fact that you have given me permission to slow down a little bit and enjoy the trail at a different pace and not feel guilty. Like I'm not out there pushing. I can back off, look at a heart rate monitor and say, this is where Dr. Maffetone wants me. And I have enjoyed those runs a lot. And I think it's helped with my gait. I think it's helped make sure that I don't end up with unnecessary injuries. And I just feel good about it. So I think, you know, I think you've increased, or the longevity of my running is going to be enhanced because of these discussions.
And Phil, I want to thank you personally myself, because Don finally has slowed down and I can keep up with him.
that's the important thing.
If the truth is not
benefit, there's a lot of benefits to slowing down. Smelling the flowers in life is one of them. But you're right. It's, you know, as an athlete, a runner in particular, it's important in many cases to slow down so that you can build up your aerobic system and actually get faster.
You know, as I saw the book title 159, I thought, you know, no matter what Phil says in here, there's no way I'm going to hit 159. You know, he may have unravel the secrets of running faster, but I'm not going to be that 159 guy. But then as I was reading it, it occurred to me that what he's doing is tuning us all up to find our own personal 159.
You know, I think you're absolutely right. Although, Don, you may hit the 159. It just may not be at the 26.2 distance.
The 13.1 distance. We all hit 159 at some point. Mark your point on the course and see where you're at 159. And that's what I liked about this book.
Yes, that could be a good, that could be a new race. People just run, and at 159, everybody stops.
One of the things I liked about it is you determine how can you run 159. You took each component of running, racing, training. As you go through the table of contents there, you really break down all the nuances of our sport, running, and you kind of dissect it a bit, and you say you could squeeze a bit more efficiency, a bit more, you could create some more speed, you could become a faster, better runner if you do these things. And so you break down all of these different phases of our running, and you can. It's a great workbook, a great tool.
You know,
thanks.
I was going to say, Dr. Phil,
what I really did was that
we lose him?
Yeah.
No, I'm here.
Oh, there you are.
I'm here.
Yep, go ahead.
What I really did was more broadly defined the issue of running economy. What is it that makes us run more economical? And then I just went through one by one and said, here's how it can be done. So I talked about running economy in terms, it's traditionally defined in terms of oxygen utilization. How much oxygen do we need to get from point A to point B? And I expanded that definition to include fat burning, which is a very scientific way to do it. But then I looked at all the factors that improve running economy, from the feet to, you know, all the aspects of the gait and so forth. And I didn't go in and say, well, if you do this, you can improve running economy by 5%, and then added up everything at the end. Maybe I should have. That would have been kind of interesting. But when you do that, you come up with numbers that are way under 159. So 159 can be considered a conservative number when you look at the ideal situation.
as you worked through some of these the differences that you know the changes that you can make, you speculated that there might even be a 159 out there already if some of these runners took some of these skill sets or tools and put them into place.
Exactly, and I have no doubt there's a 159 runner out there right now, probably competing and possibly competing at a very high level. I went through all of the current runners, marathoners who are down in the 205, 206 arena, and we could have included more. I could have included more, but I took those and I went through them systematically, and I looked at everything from injury rates to consistency, age, and other factors. And I really just came up with three Kenyans who I didn't realize it until after I had finished writing the book that these three Kenyans are training partners. Dennis Kimeto, the most recent world record holder who just broke the 203 barrier in Berlin and was one of them. But no doubt there's some really great runners with 159 potential that are up and coming, and they may be relatively unknown at this point, unless you really keep track of the young up and coming runners. But we're not that far away, so they're out there.
You know, Dr. Phil, you have a diagram in the introduction that shows a timeline as it is compared to the marathon times that shows back in the 1908 where the record was 2:55, and that's a very steep decline to, you know, the 1970s, 1980s, and then it kind of flatlines, and there's really not a whole lot of improvement. I'm curious, what kinds of things were the runners doing from the early 1900s to, let's say, the 1950s and 60s that caused such a dramatic increase or decrease in finish times? And then why has it slowed down? Is it that we've learned as much as we can, or do you think that, you know, your hypothesis is we have not reached our potential of a faster finish time? What are some of the factors that were involved in that?
Well, if anything, we've maybe learned too much. one of the things that we've done from way back when to the 50s is this thing called training. You know, it was the norm back when the Olympics first started. The training was not something people did. They would just come into an event quite often having done little or no training. You know, all of a sudden people realize, gee, if I practice my sport in the course of the year, I'll actually be better. And of course, that evolved into the overtraining epidemic, which began. I don't know. I've seen studies that were from as far back as the 1940s and 50s. So somewhere along the way, it was recognized that, well, gee, all the training we're suddenly doing now is a little bit too much, and it leads to injury, fatigue, depression, and all kinds of other things. But I think the relative change that we've recently seen, where the times have kind of plateaued and the record-breaking marathons are by a mere few seconds sometimes, is just a natural part of the transition. I think if you look at other sports, even some of the modern sports like football and basketball, and you plot things out, you'll see patterns that often will fall into a plateau before things pick up again. And I think what we're seeing now in the marathon, more than we have in the last 30 years, or certainly 25 years, are marathon time. People are running their best, and I'm talking about elite runners, running their best marathons by a minute or 2 minutes or 3 minutes. And that's, you know, that's almost unheard of today, but you're seeing that happen. So I don't think the next world record will be 159, but if that's how it turns out, I wouldn't be all that shocked.
You know, as Scott made the astute observation that there was a large slope from 1908 to the, you know, 50s and 70s, and we look at it as a community, as individuals, we have that same type of, I figured this out, you know, where you run for a while, and then all of a sudden, you know, a season or two or three into it, a light goes on, you learn how to train your body, you learn how to eat, you learn how to rest, and what works for you. Then all of a sudden, you watch some of these people's times, and they drop significantly. Like, what happened to you in the last couple of years? You've really learned how to run fast. And then we plateau a bit as we find our own personal ceiling, or it's harder to move that bar anymore.
Exactly. So. And I think a lot of people, when they find that, they get accused of doping or something, because all of a sudden they're like a newly born athlete who's got this incredible ability. And where did it come from? It's amazing how much faster you can get when you make relatively small changes, 1%, 2%, 3%, you know, do the math, in your running economy. Just wearing a lighter pair of shoes, for example, could make significant differences. Just increasing the amount of energy your muscles are fed, which you do mostly by giving it more fat, will just have, you know, have a significant impact on running economy. And it's not that hard to do, and anybody can do it.
You know, I before we get into what specific things you believe are going to be a factor in these runners going sub 2 hours, I wanted to ask you a question. Do you think that there's a psychological barrier at the 2 hour mark, like there was with the 4 minute mile? Do you think that once somebody does break that 2 hour mark, that's going to all of a sudden open up the possibility that can be done, and more? I mean, there's going to be a steep curve where people now, 4, 5, 6 people a year are going to be running 159, or 10 people or a dozen people are going to be running 159. You're going to see a high school kid run a 159. Do you think that that's going to happen, or is it going to be a little more difficult for people to reach that?
I think you're right. You're going to see somebody go under 2 hours, and all of a sudden the dam is open, and you know, even some of the countries who have had good runners but not great runners are going to be running 159. It's what happened in the 50s when Roger Bannister broke the 4 minute mile. All of a sudden, you know, gee, this is easy, and there was a floodgate of sub 4 miles. And as a matter of fact, Bannister's record was the shortest mile record ever in history. There were so many people, and not only that, but the women's 5 minute barrier was broken in 3 weeks or something after Bannister broke his 4 minute mile. So wow. Sure, it's a psychological barrier. It's a human nature barrier. You see it on a scholastic level. You see it on all different levels of human performance. So I would expect that to happen with the marathon.
You brought up something that I thought was an interesting observation. You said there's official courses and unofficial courses and some downhill courses with wind at your back courses. If someone goes out and runs a 159 on an unofficial course with all of this wind at their back, and you think that will be the floodgate that opens, or the gate doesn't officially open it until it's on an official course?
Oh, I think any course will do. That's a, you know, certified 26.2 miles. I don't know about you, but if you've ever been to the Boston Marathon and looked at some of those uphill runs along the course, you know, they don't call it Heartbreak Hill for nothing. Mm-hmm. You can't tell me that the Boston Marathon is a fast course because it doesn't have traditionally fast times. You get a good day where the weather is perfect, you're going to have fast times. But if somebody runs 1:59:59 in Boston, that's it. And yes, I think that's enough to make other runners say, hey, we could do this. That's how it works.
You know, you had mentioned the three Kenyans that are currently running that you think will be able to, you know, realistically achieve this goal. And in your book, you talk, there's a chapter called the K factor, which is the Kenyan factor. Tell us a little bit about that. It comes back to, I guess, the nature and nurture discussion or debate. Do you think that Kenyans are just built to be able to run these faster times, or do you think that it can be taught or learned or trained, and we could, you know, see an American or somebody from Great Britain breaking this 1:59 if they trained like a Kenyan?
Well, you don't have to train like a Kenyan. I think that an American, an English runner, you know, somebody from Finland again, someone from Japan. I think there's opportunities everywhere. And if you look back in history at the running, running history in general, you've seen athletes from all over the world, countries from all over the world represented in certain eras. And today, the longstanding era has been the East Africans, in particular the Kenyans. And I don't think there's anything special about the Kenyans. They're the ones that are dominating right now. That will change, and that may change soon. But I think if we look at the Kenyans and the East Africans in general, we see some very important factors that are going to be required for somebody to run 1:59. First of all, they grew up barefoot. They developed their brain and body in a barefoot state. And what better way to develop the impact mechanism where when we hit the ground and we spring up and forward, that gravitational energy that everybody talks about in a negative way when it comes to running, that energy is actually converted to usable energy to make us run faster. That mechanism exists in everybody. And those who wear shoes, it doesn't work as well. And those who grew up wearing shoes, it doesn't work as well. So the Kenyans, in a real sense, have an advantage there because they grew up without shoes, most of them. They often don't put on the first pair of shoes until they have run some local race, did well, and were given a pair of shoes as an award. The Kenyans also have lived at high altitude all their life until they became real good at running, and then they started traveling to races. And then some of them don't spend much time anymore in, you know, at these high altitudes, whether it's in Kenya or wherever. And that's a problem because I think that has a diminishing effect on their running economy. Because they live at high altitude, they tend to be shorter in stature. They tend to be smaller individuals, so their muscles are not big and bulky, which means they're very light. And the lighter you are in weight, the better your running economy. So there's a number of factors that the Kenyans possess, and are those factors, can those factors be applied to other runners around the world? Certainly, yes. The problem is that even though we have these genetic gifts, you know, we're born and we become a young adult of shorter stature and thinner muscles, and we we do control a lot of our environment, such as living at altitude, spending more time barefoot, eating well, being healthy, being in the sun. Vitamin D is such an important piece to this puzzle. And so we control a lot of it.
I'd like to pull out of chapter 9, Feet First, just this short paragraph. And I hate to read the author his own book, but I've got to tell you, I love this.
I'd rather
this,
you do it than me.
I got to say, I love this whole concept that we are meant to run, and that our bodies are efficient machines. And so here's what you write. When a runner's foot properly hits the ground, impact energy is first stored in the muscles and tendons. Right away, 95% of this energy is then used to help spring the body forward like a pogo stick. This mechanism provides about half the energy required for leg and foot muscle propulsion, and with the other half coming from sugar and fat metabolism. I think that is such a brilliant statement, and it gives me, just as I'm running, I'm thinking, I am built to run. My foot is efficient, and when we start covering the foot with large cushions, we lose some of these fine developed mechanisms that we have.
Or on the other side of the coin, Don.
What's that?
Some of us are wasting half of the potential energy that we have.
I can run a 159.
Yes, and it's a that's a, you know, that it is very important. Some of us are wasting, you know, X amount of that energy. The question is, well, if we don't use that 95% of that gravitational impact, where does that energy go? It doesn't just disappear. Energy doesn't disappear. It actually goes into our muscles, our joints, and it has to be converted to heat. We irritate our body because we can't use this energy for propulsion. So it goes into injuring us, essentially. And that's another very, very important factor.
Yeah, into the meniscus, into your plantar fascia, that's a nagging chronic injury because of inefficiency mm-hmm. in gait.
So exactly. Here's the question I have. Are these elite runners, do they have the potential to become or run more efficient than they currently are? I mean, they're the best athletes in the world. They're the best runners in the world. Are you contending, or are you saying that there still may be, maybe they're only at using their muscles and tendons and everything, their running form, and they're only getting 48% of that potential 50%? Is there room
sure.
for improvement?
Yeah. I think there are a number of factors that if they were in place, we wouldn't be talking about breaking the 2-hour marathon. We'd be talking about, mm-hmm. you know, can anybody run under 155? That seems like a natural barrier where the human body can't run, you know. And the first one is shoes. Imagine some of these great Kenyans or Ethiopians who are running 202 and change now, 203, 204, 205, and look at how much energy they're wasting by wearing shoes. And then we have to look at, well, why are they wearing shoes? They've grown up barefoot. They've developed themselves into great athletes barefoot. They start winning races in Kenya. They win a pair of shoes. And then what happens? Somebody comes up to them and hands them a bunch of money and says, wear my shoes and this is all yours. Well, that's the most money they've ever imagined, let alone seen, for someone in Kenya or Ethiopia. That's, you know, that's 20 years wages right there in this guy's hand. And here, you know, all you got to do is wear my shoes. Well, okay. So I think one of the interesting things that we're going to see is that some up and coming runner from somewhere is, you know, we've had a history of seeing barefoot runners do well in races. We've seen gold medals. We've seen local races where people have done well. But on the international scene, if we see somebody run a 201:30 marathon barefoot, that's going to change the landscape. Because what has happened is that I don't know if it's that runners are unaware or that they just want to take the money and run. But if you're the first guy, and women will do this down the road, if you're the first guy to run 159, you're going to be worth more than any shoe contract. You're going to be a king, a god. People are going to want to know what your political convictions are. They're going to ask you, you know, can you name my new child? You know, this guy is going to be one of the highest paid people in sports. And the amount of money that potentially they'll have is going to make any shoe contract, which, you know, are not like they used to be pennies compared to what their potential earnings will be. So I think when that happens, and I think it'll happen when a barefoot runner comes along and makes that kind of scene, things will start changing in terms of shoe wearing, which is just one of many, many factors that will help people run better.
One of the points that you make is if you're going to run 159, everything needs to be as right as possible, you know, or whatever the world record's going to be. So if the shoe's going to slow you down a little bit, then the shoe's got to go. I mean, everything has to be tuned perfectly, and there's no room for extra in this equation of 159.
Sure. That's the case, for any runner who has a great day. It's a great day because everything worked, including the weather being good, and your brain working as well as it can work. Of course, the training is you've got to be great in training. And I often use Vince Lombardi, Hall of Fame football coach, who had a great saying about that, which is practice does not make perfect. Perfect practice makes perfect. And so to run 159, you've got to have some really perfect training under your belt.
So let's get into this running economy thing. We talked about running economy and how important that is even for the elite runners. Let's talk about the Joe Schmo day-to-day runner, me, Don, you know, whoever else is out there listening to this. I've heard interviews with you saying, okay, do I need to go to a class to learn how to run better? And I've heard you actually say that's absurd. that we all should know how to run personally to our best economy.
Intuitively.
And the best way to do that, I've heard you say, and I want you to say it again to prove that I listened to you correctly, is just take off your shoes. And very quickly, your brain and your body will tell you what is the best efficiency you can run. Is that correct?
The way to figure out your best running gait is to take off your shoes and run and not think about it. And even more than that is to not have, we all have this image in our head when we go out for a run. Whether it's a conscious image, and I know many people have that, and I sometimes think about it, or a subconscious image. We have these images because we've seen the lead pack in the Boston Marathon or the Berlin Marathon on TV or on the computer. We've been at races where we've seen the leaders come through, and we have this image in our brains of this so-called perfect gait. And some of us have better gaits than others, and there's a lot of reasons for it, but we have to, and the brain naturally tends to do that. If you look at somebody move, your brain, while you're standing there watching someone move, your brain is making the connections with the muscle fibers that will attempt to make you move in the same way. That's just, they're called mirror neurons, and we have them in our brain, and it's why we can see a runner from far away and know who it is without seeing their face. But if we just go out and run, but take off our shoes, because that eliminates the impairment we get from shoes, then we will fall into our most efficient gait. It may not be pretty, but it's the most efficient gait, considering the imbalances that we have and the bad habits that we've developed. And then the question is, well, how can we get rid of some of those bad habits? And that's where running economy comes back. We need to improve our ability to burn fat, so our muscles have more fuel. We need to breathe properly. Maybe we've learned to breathe improperly. Maybe we don't have rhythm. People who can't dance. People who can't keep time to music. They just don't run as well because their cerebellum in their brain isn't working very well, and we have to kind of retrain them with a metronome so they can restore their natural rhythm. So, you know, but I think finding our gait right now is as easy as taking off our shoes and going out and running.
You know, we're right in the middle of chapter 4 with that topic because I have the table of contents in front of me. And so really, this is a book that you can just open up and just learn everywhere. So Runner of One is the title of chapter 4. And you say there's no one way. And so it kind of makes me think that if Scott's a Porsche and I'm a, you know, a what would I be? Some kind
You're
of international
You're
truck.
A Jeep.
Yeah. We're going to take corners differently. And there's no one way to do it. We're all individuals. So it's really, you don't have to mimic every single person and expect the same outcome.
Exactly. And that's a really important point, because what happens is when we do try to mimic somebody else, whether it's somebody in our local club who runs really well, or someone that, you know, we look on, watch a YouTube clip of to see how well they're running, we try to mimic them. One of the things that happens, beside not being able to run quite as fast, we often get injured because we're not running within our body. We're not running within our own balance, and that's a very, very important factor.
Yeah. I was going to say, you know, I love, there's a video out there of Anton Kropitschka. His body type and my body type are so similar. I'm joking.
You both have legs.
I'm being very sarcastic. We're completely built differently, and I watched that video, and he just looks effortless, and I see that he has this running efficiency you're talking about, and I try to use these mirror neurons that you're talking about to try to implant that into my own body, and I just get frustrated because for some reason I can't do what he does. And I like this chapter because it says, you know what, running economy is an individual thing. There's some basic common threads, but you shouldn't. And it's not bad. I guess it's not bad to watch those guys because it helps us try to be better. But it all comes down to what each of us individually find on our own is running economy.
Exactly. And every one of us can improve our running economy, period. I mean, that's the bottom line of the book. And really, my whole program is that we can become better athletes by being more economical, and there's a whole bunch of ways to become more economical.
You write in there, it says, it's difficult for runners to assess themselves. Can you expand on that a bit?
I think it's difficult for any of us to evaluate every aspect of us. And, you know, in healthcare, we often say, something about, you know, if the doctor who treats himself as a fool for a patient, and I've gotten in trouble myself with that. Mm-hmm. So we often need help from another person, from somebody who has more expertise, or possibly just a running partner who can say, hey, you know, why does your leg flare out? Why does your thigh immediately rotate and your foot flare out a lot more on one side than the other? This is important information. It's hard for you to see that yourself, because if you start looking down, or if you're running in a shopping center at 6 o'clock in the morning when there's no one around, but there's a lot of glass you're running by, and you try to analyze your gait by looking over, you know, it's going to change your gait, so you're not going to have a normal gait. Just difficult to evaluate ourselves.
You know, and I had a thought as I was reading through your material about treadmills, and your thoughts on, do you think that they can develop some bad habits, because they're very different than running on the road or a trail?
Sure, they're unnatural. Here you are running along, and your brain is saying, where are we going? We're not going anywhere, but we're running. I'm confused. It's not natural, and therefore we're going to run a little differently. We're going to train our body a little differently. Now, if you live in Wyoming and you're a serious marathoner, I don't know why you'd live in Wyoming in the winter if you were a serious marathoner.
Hey, careful. I'm from Wyoming, Dr. Phil. Be careful. I am.
It's a beautiful country.
That's why I live in California.
Right. Yeah. There are going to be days when you're just not going to be able to go out and run, and you don't want to take more than 1 or 2 days off, so you run on your treadmill. That's okay. But if you spend, you know, all of your running time in the course of the winter on the treadmill, then that could be a problem. I think you have to try to run in as natural a state as possible. And a treadmill is okay now and then when it's not possible to go outside at 30 below, not even considering the wind chill. But on a regular basis, you want to try to be out there on a trail, especially, which is even more natural than on pavement. And by doing that, I think you develop your body better.
It might even be a better idea, rather than running on a treadmill, to get on a stationary bike or swim in a pool or something to keep your aerobic fitness, right?
Sure. That would be a more natural movement, especially swimming. Going to, you know, you can't do a lot of running in a mall, but I know that many people would go to, you know, walkers would go to a mall in the morning, and the malls have learned to open their doors to walkers because all these walkers come through and window shop. But it's a nice, you know, safe enclosed area. Not the best for running, but you could jog in there, and you can also walk in there. Walking is a wonderful thing, and I think everyone from a 159 marathoner to a beginner jogger would benefit from walking, because you develop those nice, slow-moving aerobic muscle fibers that bring in a lot of circulation to the rest of the fibers and help drain lymphatics and do all kinds of other things that are very healthy as well.
Dr. Phil, I feel somewhat like a student back in grammar school when I'd take a test and there was a question I just didn't understand, and I'd go up to the teacher and I was just, explain this to me. And once he or she did, a light went on. I said, well, no kidding. And that's what I feel like with this question. Chapter 6, overreaching versus overtraining. You lay out undertraining, which I get because I've undertrained before. Overtrained. I've witnessed somebody overtrain, and maybe I had even reached into that. But you talk about the sweet spot being overreaching, and that term just doesn't fit with me. I need some help.
Well, it's a term that has been used a lot in exercise physiology Unfortunately, like in many areas of exercise physiology, terms are thrown around and often used in ways that are sometimes opposite the way somebody else used the term. But overreaching is a term that's used to describe, you know, what state can we get into where it's beyond easy training, where we just go out and jog, but it's not as far along as where we trash ourselves and get overtrained. And that has been defined as overreaching, and I've used that term a lot because it makes sense. We can call it something else if you want to make up a name.
No, I'm good. I just need to understand overreaching because I think overreaching means you've gone a bit too far. If I overreach across the table to get the, you know, the mashed potatoes, and that's usually it's called overreaching to me.
So it's the sweet spot. The sweet spot.
Yeah, I think the sweet spot, and that's why I use that word, because it really defines what that is. And you know, if you're a serious athlete, or even if you're just having fun, you know, going out and racing it once or twice a month or three times a month or every week, and you want to find that sweet spot, you can. It'll take a little bit more work. It's not just like going out and jogging. And you know, the problem is today that we have a significant social component to racing. There's all these clubs, people get together. You know, I think the surveys that are done on people who go to gyms, for example, not surprisingly, when people are asked, you know, why do they come to the gym, the most popular answer is because of social reasons. You know, I like being around people, I like talking, I like picking up women, I like, you know, as opposed to, well, I want to develop my fitness. I need to balance, you know, my health. I want to get stronger. Or I want to get, you know, whatever. And the running community is the same way. There's a lot of social component, and sometimes as much as is that can be a lot of fun, it can sometimes steer our training either too far forward into overtraining or too far back into undertraining and away from that sweet spot.
One of the things that I would say probably stuck with me the most that I've learned from you is that these long distance endurance races are aerobic events that you're. And why would you go out and train anaerobically when the system that you need to use is aerobic? And one of the charts or chapters in there that you talk about is a marathon is 99% anaerobic or fat burning. Well, anaerobic? No, aerobic. My notes are off. So it's anaerobic. That even with at 26.2, we're mostly using a fat burning mechanism to run that race.
Well, the correct way to put it is that the we get 99% of our energy from the aerobic system. Mm-hmm. We don't necessarily get 99% of our energy from fat. The aerobic system burns a high amount of fat, but we still use glucose. We're always using both glucose and fat. And so it's the aerobic system, but the question still remains, why are people trying to rev up their anaerobic system by doing track intervals when they're going to be doing a race that's mostly or almost entirely aerobic in nature? And when we look at the marathon is sort of the cutoff. When you start getting down to a half marathon, things change quickly, and then of course down to a 10K and a 5K. But by the marathon, you're using, you know, so we're looking at a 2-hour say a 2 to 3 hour event in many cases. And when we start getting above that level, we're using even more aerobic energy. But another way to look at it is the fact that when we race in a marathon, we're only using about 80% or depending on the runner, 80% of our VO2 max. we're not at our max level, certainly. It might feel that way if we're not having a good race, but we're only at 80%. And when you start getting up to a longer ultra event, we could be down to 70%. And so in those races, people are not even going to be racing at a heart rate that goes over their max aerobic level, training level. And so that's those are very, very important things to think about, because your training should match your race goals.
Do you feel that there's a place for some speed work for the ultra distance athlete?
I think it depends on the athlete, but in most cases, I think you have to look at, what is this speed work going to do for me? Am I going to ever be running at that pace? Probably not. Are there any risks in training anaerobically? There are most certainly are risks, more risks training anaerobically than anything else you can do in training. Mm-hmm. So it's about risk reward. And then also, when I do this anaerobic training, is it going to take away from my aerobic system, which is often the case? And so, you know, I'm just looking at the speed you're going to be running at. You know, I've gone through this with so many athletes throughout my career. They'll say, well, I'm going to the track and I want to do 90-second quarters with a one-lap jog. And I said, okay, well, you know, you're going to do this 10K. What's your projected time? Well, I'm hoping to be able to break 50 minutes. You know, your 90-second quarters, that's a six-minute pace you're trying to emulate. And most likely this person who's trying to break 50 minutes in a 10K, you know, I mean, that could be all-out speed for that person. So you have to look at those relationships very carefully. Are you going to be using that speed? Are you going to even come close to that speed? I mean, it's one thing to say, okay, I'm doing shorter events and I have a goal to run at this pace. And so I'm going to, even though I've never run that fast, I'm going to break that into quarters or half mile or mile repeats. And I'm going to run that goal pace on the track in small segments. And, you know, that's the whole concept of intervals. But if you're, you know, if you're night and day between the track interval times and your race times, that's a problem. That's called imbalance. And many people get in trouble by doing that.
So we drive past the track and into the gym. What's your thoughts on strength training for endurance athlete?
I think the problem that endurance athletes have is they, especially as they get older and they get out of that situation where they're in their 20s and they're running fast, short races, and they've got this lingering strength that they developed when they were maybe track and field runners or short runners. And in many of those cases, you know, people never went through that experience. But when we get into our 30s and above, because muscle contraction in an endurance running doesn't develop much power in those muscles, we start getting weaker. And a good way to evaluate yourself is to just see how high you can jump from a standing, you know, flat-footed, barefooted jump. And a lot of runners, even in their 30s and 40s, can jump more than 12 inches, 15, 18 inches. If you look at some of the track runners, even the ones that are not great track runners, they could jump 2 feet or more. And the difference between the two is strength. And so I think a lot of endurance athletes have lost strength, and the lack of strength is a problem, and they can get it back with weightlifting if they're careful. And the caveat there is being careful, which means not inducing fatigue. So if you do a weight workout and the next day you're sore, you've overdone it. That's what I would call, for an endurance athlete, overtraining. So you want to keep your weightlifting short, like 6 repetitions. You want to make your weightlifting, you want to do it very, very carefully and avoid the traditional things. And you can really do it quite easily with some full body lifts, like a squat, where you pick up a weight off the floor and you bring it up to your chest and you squat down and then you put the weight down. Okay, that's one. You do 5 or 6 of those, and you do that maybe 3 or 4 times, but you have to rest between your sets, and the whole goal is to not induce excessive fatigue, which is where the soreness comes from. So you want to build yourself up in a way that you don't notice any soreness the next day. And if you can do that, then you'll get stronger without interfering with your aerobic system, and you won't mess up your gait, which is the other problem that excessive fatigue will do.
Will the runner, the athlete that runs the first 159, incorporate strength training in his routine?
I think if he is an older runner, for a runner of that caliber, meaning someone in their later 30s, then I think strength training would have been introduced at some point, because, you know, by their late 20s and early 30s, that natural strength that many of them actually had, because they were, in most cases, they were all shorter distance champions. They were all great 5K runners, great 10K runners. So they had strength. But as they start to lose it, they're going to have to get it back with strength training. So, yeah, I think if a 38-year-old breaks the 2-hour barrier, he probably would have been doing strength training to help get him there.
If you grabbed one of us, mid-pack runner, well, just anybody, would you incorporate some strength training? A good strategy for, say, Scott or I or whomever else is running next to us, to include that as a way to prevent injury, to sustain some longevity in the sport and enjoy running?
It can do all those things and more, but it can also contribute to overtraining and injuries. And so it all comes down to how well you do it. And that using fatigue as a guide is a real good way to assure that you're doing it safely. But would I recommend that for everyone? I don't recommend too many things for everyone, other than eating good food versus junk food. I think we always have to look at a person and say, this is a problem, your strength levels are low, you're only able to jump 10 inches. That's not acceptable if you're trying to, run a 220 marathon, or if you're trying to run a 5.5-hour 50 miler or whatever. And go from there. And so individualization is really the important thing.
You mentioned nutrition, Dr. Phil, and there is a chapter on nutrition in this book. Is there anything in this book that is different or evolved from what I call the Red Bible, the big book of health and fitness? You talk about nutrition quite a bit in that book and a little bit in the big yellow Bible. Is there anything different that we would learn in this nutrition chapter of this book that is not in the Red Bible?
I'm glad you bring up the color coding, because I remember numbers and I remember colors, but I don't remember names well.
I just call it the Red Book and the Yellow Book.
Yeah, that's what I call it. And um, I don't know the answer to that. No doubt there's new information in 159. There's nothing dramatic. But I think one thing that might be different is in 159, I don't think I talk about the 2-week test. At least lately, I haven't been doing that. I basically am thinking, you know, we're all adults. And if you want to get better, just don't eat junk food. Mm-hmm. Just stop eating junk food. And don't play around with this 2-week test thing to see how you feel. Sure, you feel better. Okay, now let's see if we can, you know, put back some fruit and put back this. The bottom line is that insulin is our worst enemy. And if you're trying to be a better endurance athlete, the more you can reduce your insulin levels, the better you're going to run, the better you're going to race, because the more fat you're going to utilize. And so eating 6 fruits a day is probably going to end up causing you to produce more insulin, which means you're going to produce you're going to burn less fat for energy. So I think I've started doing that in 159, and I've done that in some articles I've written where I just say, look, you know, you can do the 2-week test and experiment, but the bottom line is, don't eat junk food. How simple can it be? You want to be a better runner? Stop eating sugar.
You know, the statement that you made, if you're out running or you're driving and listening to this podcast and you didn't take out your mental highlighter when Dr. Phil said that insulin is bad for you, and anything that spikes that insulin, don't eat it. That should have been mentally highlighted. The page should have been dog-eared. That is so important, and I think that that is one of the things that I have personally learned from you, Dr. Phil, is insulin is bad. The insulin spike is bad. And if you eat anything that ramps that up quick, it's avoid it like the plague.
Yeah,
and is what that is.
It is poison. I have an article on the website called The Insulin Villain, and it's easy to find. But you know, the foods that we even a lot of the natural foods that are consumed by people, even when they're purchased in Whole Foods or some health food store, these are dangerous foods because they produce large amounts of insulin, and that no matter how well we train, no matter you know, whether we have the greatest of coaches or the best running shoes or the best schedule, with all that insulin coming out, your economy is going to go down the tubes because your fat burning is going to be trashed.
Dr. Maffetone, another great hour just flew by. We're only halfway through the race, actually. We're at the 13.1 mark, but it's such a great book, and every chapter is loaded with things that you could read at one time and then go back through the chapter and go, "Well, I missed that because I was thinking about how I can improve myself here, and I glossed right over that other thing that I need to do." So it's a great book, and every chapter really holds something that we can implement and improve and become better runners, happier runners, healthier runners. And so I think it's a fantastic book.
And as we were preparing for this podcast, I think Don hit the nail square on the head, through the board.
What did I say?
He said, you know, this book is 159. It's about a marathon, elite marathon runner running a 159 marathon, which is really out of the realm for the majority of us.
I was worried
about the far majority.
Dr. Phil, I was worried because you were only going to sell about 1 to 3 books.
And what Don said,
I was worried about that too.
and what Don said that kind of, you know, just kind of made a bell go off in my head is we all have a 159, and this book can help us get to that goal. So it's not about how I can train to be a 159 marathoner. It may be how I can, you know, run my first sub 24-hour 100-miler. It could be, getting out of bed and running three days a week instead of two.
Injury-free, feeling good, yeah. Enjoying it.
So I think
like
that this book...
Like it's supposed to be, yep.
Right.
I think this book is for everyone. And thank goodness, Amazon is for everyone. This book is available on Amazon. If you look for it, if you just Google 1:59 Dr. Phil Maffetone, the book is titled 1:59, The Sub-2-Hour Marathon is Within Reach. Here's how it will go down and what it can teach all runners about training and racing.
Mm-hmm.
We're excited. It was a Thanks. Great book. Everybody should have this in their Phil Maffetone library of running books.
Where do you put it, Scott? In between the red and the yellow, or on the left or right side?
It's on the right side.
On the right side?
Yeah, it's on the right side. The Bible, this is a supplement to the Bibles.
Okay.
Dr. Phil, thank you very much. We enjoy our conversations with you. We always come away with little bits of knowledge that we try to incorporate in our running, and I know I've become a better runner because of it. So thank you very much.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.
Hey, previously, we closed the show with something, because Dr. Maffetone, not only is he an athlete, a coach, and a thought leader, but he's a musician as well. And last podcast, we closed with a song that you sent over. I'd like to be able to do the same. You don't have to tell us which song it is now, and I'm assuming you're giving us permission to do it. We'd love sure. just to play a little short snippet of some of your great sounds.
Sure, that would be great. And I spend most of my time doing it these days, writing music and recording. So, be my pleasure.
Awesome. Well, what the song you're about to hear is Dr. Phil Maffetone on the what do you call it? The guitar and the mic. Go out and run and listen.
Mas.
Every little ache, one forsaken heartbreak, deep down in the middle of my chest for all to see. Staring at the pain within, crying's just a game of sin. Everything is one and the same. Everything is one and the same. It's a scary life as we know it. Be weary of the dice when you throw it all away. Don't be near.